I think there's an understanding in the United States, Mexico, and Canada that the final termination of native people is going to occur. Krejci now sees his opportunity, and he's in the final stages of being prime minister, to really push the white paper through.
A genocidal mentality is inherently ecocidal in its implications. It eradicates the habitat that you, as well as we, depend upon for survival. You combine genocide and ecocide, you get omnicide.
Introducing a four-part series on CKUT 90.3. Legislation will be presented this spring, potentially changing Canada's relationship with Native North America forever. Tune into this station for long-term memory radio. A four-part series on Canada's relationship with Native North America every Wednesday throughout February from 5 to 6 p.m.
The liberation of Native North America becomes priority number one for anyone serious about ultimately winning the struggle at hand.
CKUT, long-term memory radio.
In 1884, the federal government of Canada asserted that they aimed to, quote, make Indians white men in the eyes of the law, end quote. Fast forward to 2002, and some would say that little has changed. The current federal government will be seeking to replace the Indian Act with the First Nations Governance Act and the First Nations Financial Institutional Act. While the Canadian government is seeking final solutions to unresolved Aboriginal treaties and other issues, the lack of consultation with natives and the focus on passing federal legislation leave some asking, are First Nations ready for the drastic redefinition of their rights and powers as this country's original peoples and owners? This four-part series of the Long-Term Memory Radio Project is dedicated to discussing the issues around the federal government's latest attempt to redefine its, and subsequently the Canadian people's, relationship with our Aboriginal neighbors. Part 1 will bring the Indian Act and the current legislation into focus. Part 2 includes a discussion about Native resistance movements and the media's systematically poor coverage of Native issues. Part 3 is dedicated to understanding how the Canadian government's policies have impacted Aboriginal women. And Part 4 will be produced by youth from Montreal's Native Friendship Center. Stay tuned for long-term memory radio on this station.
It was our land.
Defend the territory.
Without reservation.
Defend the territory.
Without reservation.
Defend the territory.
Without reservation.
Defend the territory.
Welcome to part two of our special four-part series on the Indian Act, covering the history behind current policies of the Canadian government towards Native peoples. Tonight we'll be featuring a conversation with two journalists about what is right and wrong with the mainstream media's coverage of Aboriginal issues. We will also turn to Arthur Manuel, who has recently been organizing land rights actions in British Columbia, for a look ahead at what resistance might look like around current attempts to amend the Indian Act. First up, Allison Blackduck and Peter Edwards, speaking about journalism and coverage of Native issues. Peter Edwards is a reporter for the Toronto Star and author of One Dead Indian, The Premier, The Police, and the Ipperwash Crisis. Allison Blackduck has worked as a journalist for 9 years, and she currently lives in Yellowknife. She has also been writing a biweekly column at the Toronto Star for over a year. I asked Allison if she was surprised that in 2002, she is the only Indigenous journalist with a column in a major Canadian daily.
Sort of, but not really. And I think one thing that people have to remember is if you're going with print, and even with radio, it's sometimes hard to identify whether a journalist is Indigenous just by the name. And I think that for some reason, I think it's because there's this big emphasis on the oral culture of Native peoples. I think that there's been more of a push for broadcast journalism amongst the Native communities, or at least just getting, you know, radio stations, community radio stations up and running. So I think that a lot of those people who might be interested in maybe doing more print journalism or, like, hardcore radio journalism are probably more involved in softer coverage. And so I think there are people out there, but I don't think that they're really pushing to work at major news organizations.
Well, Peter, you're also at the Toronto Star.
Mm-hmm.
And what was your first experience in covering Indigenous issues there?
Some of it was just straight crisis stuff, like you know, smuggling it across Sasni, that sort of thing, where it's not really an indigenous issue, it's a crime issue, and you would just have that sort of backdrop to it. I just, you know, by chance ended up at the shooting of Dudley George shortly afterwards, and then that's something I've been covering for about 6.5 years, and so that, you know, that's basically where it sort of begins and ends for me.
For those who don't know, can you just briefly summarize what the shooting of Dudley George involved?
It was in September 1995, and there was a land claim dispute where the protesters waited until all the tourists had left the park, had left this provincial park, and so there's no one else there. They're upset because they've been waiting, I think it was 58 years, for a fence to be put up around grave sites, and instead there were horseshoe pits on top of them. So it was a pretty easy to understand dispute. Coupled with that was the fact that some neighboring land had been taken by the federal government under the War Measures Act in 1942 with the promise that it would be returned at the end of the Second World War, and that land just hadn't been returned. So there were a lot of really destabilizing, ugly things that had happened to this very small group of people near London, Ontario. Anyway, that night, 7 police opened fire. One Native person was killed. Another one was beaten until his heart stopped. And when it all went to trial, it was concluded by a judge that none of the Native people were armed, like not one of them. And so that's been a real sore point with a lot of people, is why no inquiry when I could go on and on about all the abuses. I mean, there was a St. John's ambulance, what looked like a St. John's ambulance vehicle that in fact was a police command post that violates the Geneva Convention. The police were sent down at night with guns that fire 800 bullets a minute, which is obviously unsafe. A huge amount of money was pumped into it when it turned out that the protesters were in fact right. If someone had just checked the files, just checked the paperwork, they would have found out that the points they were making were totally valid. They had been promised this for a couple generations.
Well, obviously it's a very deep and large issue. I mean, you published a whole book on it called One Did Any. And when you first came to the scene, what were some of the encounters that you were having with other journalists there?
Well, the first, you know, the thing that really, really hit me, and the thing that I'll remember the rest of my life about going there was I got there around 3:30 in the morning. It was just pitch black, and I got out of my car, and I have two cameras, and as soon as I got out of the car and the First Nations people could see a white guy with cameras and obviously media, people started running behind me because they figured the police wouldn't shoot a white guy, and I found that just really, really troubling. Just the feeling, and it turned out to be a valid feeling, that they're treated differently than that. Just stand behind the white guy and you'll be in less danger. That was a really haunting thing. As the story went on, I found a lot of media don't mind doing stories about tragic Native issues or about colorful Native issues, but they really don't want to get into the political stuff. They really don't want to get into things that, what was the government's role in something. It's interesting, though, because now the media really is everybody's pushing for an inquiry. I mean, the Globe editorials and the Star editorials are basically the same. You know, we have shorter words and fewer commas, but that's about the same thing. everybody's on the same boat now, and it's kind of refreshing. Once it took a long, long time to turn around. Like, there's going to be a rally in 3 weeks, and they expect 1,600 people out, and you couldn't have gotten 200 people out 2 years ago. So it's like turning around the Titanic. It's taken a long time to get people to realize something went wrong, but now that it's just sort of anchored in there that we were lied to, people really, really are genuinely upset, and that cuts right across all the media, I think.
Well, when Allison was speaking before about the constraints of at least the paper medium and writing in a news column, you only have 400 to 700 words sometimes. Was it difficult for you to convince your editor that, you know, this quote needed to stay or this bit of information needed to be there?
Some of that's just the, it's just some things you have to learn for the job. Like, you can really only make one or two points in the story, and so it's dangerous to try more. Also, frankly, I'd rather have 5 stories of 20 inches each than one long 100-inch one that scares people away. Like, I'd rather have more headlines. I mean, when I started off in journalism, Watergate was the big thing, and the Washington Post covered that with a whole bunch of of stories that had an impact on one or two points and then ended. They didn't try to tell the whole thing in three or four pages. But I think that just scares people away. So I think a lot of it is, if you're making your living in this business, you have to get a feeling of playing the system. And, you know, for Ipperwash, it was just make one or two points and then get out and then save the other ones for another day. And if you can make a point on a Monday, it's way better than a Friday. You know, then for the whole week it can bubble around, and then you just do it again the next Monday.
And Allison, what about your columns? You're not exactly shooting for headlines, are you?
Not really, but I mean, it's nice when I get like reaction, like from readers, like in terms of email or in terms of the editorial tone I see in other newspapers sometimes afterwards, or to see that something just surfaces that maybe I'd written about, you know, a couple of months previous. So I'm not really searching for headlines. I want to, you know, provoke and evoke, I guess, is what I'm really, and just kind of get in there just a little bit. I'm not there to, you know, raise people's consciousness, but, you know, just give them a little kick in the ass sometimes. Luckily, I am really, 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 really fortunate because I have Indigenous and non-Indigenous readers, and that was one thing I was really concerned about when I started. I didn't want to become this, you know, this Indian explaining Indians to non-Indians. I'm really touched that that my readers come from all walks, and I think that, I don't know, I think that anybody who works in the media who is, I guess, from a so-called marginalized position would really understand what I was saying, you know. I'm not just speaking sometimes to the converted, and that's important.
Now, did you have a fear of when you first came to the Toronto Star that you, now that you had been given a column or at least a biweekly column, that you were being put up on some kind of pedestal and told now you speak for the native, all native peoples?
No, because I the person who really I think helped me get, you know, who really, I think, lobbied for me to get the column, and I may be totally way off on this, but it was Carol Gore. And Carol Gore, like, the first time I ever wrote an op-ed piece for her, she scared me because she was so smart, and so she just, and she knows language so well. And so when she offered it to me, I wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking about the fact that somebody saw something that really needed, saw me, I guess, or a voice that needed a venue. And I was really more than happy to take it, and I'm not hemmed in by my ethnicity, but it's something I enjoy writing about. I really not my ethnicity, but you know, issues that happen to people who are like me, and also identity politics, I think, make for some, you know, fascinating writing and reading sometimes. So yeah, I mean, my background is communication studies from Concordia, so go figure, you know. I'm all into, like, the construction of the person and gender and everything.
Mm-hmm. Peter, what about your experience covering Dudley George? Do you find that you're most often now looked to cover some Indigenous issue, whatever happens to come up now at the Toronto Star?
One thing I find is a lot of First Nations people are calling me when they have a story, like, thinking that, you know, that you can put the same energy into something else. And you know, it's sad when you have when people see you as the only kind of portal into the thing. Not the only one, but just, you know, if reporters on staff, that sometimes there seem to be a lot of calls where people sort of hope you can, you know, go out there and wave a magic wand or whatever. And I find that a little troubling because I just can't do that. But yeah, it's funny because the Dudley George thing, in the end, I just find incredibly uplifting that, you know, I was at a meeting last night and there were 20 people who are putting in a huge, huge amount of time into this rally that's a month from now, and they're just so troubled by it, and it's gotten into two textbooks, and it's nice to know that every once in a while it, you know, it does work, and people, I think the thing is that we have, in my job, we have to learn how to catch people's attention. Like, we can't always blame readers. We have to think, you know, maybe I haven't packaged it right. Maybe I haven't done it right. Maybe if I took better pictures that night, it would have hit people stronger. Maybe, you know, a lot of times I find myself thinking back, what could I have done better back then that would have moved the thing along? I mean, I can't always say, oh, it's the paper, it's the readers. I mean, maybe I could have done a better job, and maybe I should be, you know, sharpening my skills.
Mm.
You know, both of you seem to be speaking from the perspective that journalism can somehow cause social change.
Of course it can.
Oh, that's why I'm in it, really. I mean, otherwise I'd work for an ad agency and make more money. But like, I think, you know, there's just sometimes you have a feeling that things are wrong, and there's sometimes that, you know, when people don't think that they have a voice, they don't think anyone's listening, then I think sometimes you can at least get someone on the agenda. You know, after that, it, you know, who knows what'll happen. But, I mean, I think it sounds bizarre, but I think in the end our job is just to listen to people. And, you know, it's funny how many people feel that they just, that nobody really cares, that their issues don't really matter. You know, they think it's all done by these media gods somewhere, and that, you know, they just don't count.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I understand what Peter's saying, too, about, you know, people soliciting him or asking, you know, can you help me? Because I get that sometimes, too, where people will send me information packages, videos, and sometimes, I mean, I just have to use my judgment and say, you know, this is just going to fall like a lead weight, and I just can't do anything with it right now. And sometimes I just have to totally ignore some of the requests that come my way. And I think that that's a bit, I guess, unfortunate. But sometimes, I mean, just because somebody would want me to do a story doesn't mean that the story needs to be done. Like, you know that, Peter, right?
Oh, yeah. And really, you know, sometimes you feel like saying to them, you know, if you get 20 inches on page 20, is your life going to be any better? Is your, you know, dog going to wag its tail more? Is your wife going to smile more? Is your food going to taste better? Like, you know, just get a life. Sometimes, I mean, it sounds awful, but sometimes you feel like saying to people, you know, there's a real world, you know, outside of the media. You don't need us. One thing that's really hit me on this, the whole Deadly George thing is, you know, Susan Sontag's idea that as soon as you take a picture, the event becomes more important just because you took the picture. And at Ipperwash, there just was no defining picture, and so for a long, long time, people treated it like it was less important. I mean, it haunted me, but I thought, geez, if I could have gotten one really, really good picture in the first couple hours, that might have turned things around, that might have moved things ahead. And it's odd because it's got me thinking that maybe I should have stuck a camera in people's faces a little quicker. Maybe I shouldn't have hung back so much.
I do have some power sometimes, but I only get to borrow, you know, for a brief moment, and then it goes back out there. But it's also I feel like a huge, I mean, it comes with a lot of responsibility, that power, and you know, it can be used well, and it can be used stupidly. And I mean, I'm saying that for myself too. And I think that Peter alluded to that, not in that, you know, sometimes if something falls like a lead weight, then maybe I did something, like he did something wrong, and I can say the same thing for myself. You know, it's a. I guess journalism is a tool, but it takes a lot of training and also experience to make it hit exactly where it should, and sometimes it won't, and a lot of times it doesn't.
And I think people have to, somewhere down the line, people have to react on a really, really personal level. Like, it has to be not academic and not an issue and not the left and not the right, but something that just stops them and hits them and makes them think of really basic things, you know, their parents, their kids, their partner, you know, it's got to hit something really, 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 really basic. And I think what Ipperwash did was, you have this brother who all he wants to know is why his other brother was shot to death, and he's been just jerked around for 6.5 years to an unbelievable extent. And I've heard a lot of people describe Sam George's problem as like David and Goliath, so it's hit them as, you know, what if that was my brother, or there was a man who came home from the Second World War and his house was gone, and he had volunteered and fought for 5 years, and now he couldn't get back into his home to see his mother's grave. And so it's funny, but that one hit a lot of people on the right, like people you wouldn't think would be sympathetic, were in really religious people. That story really, really outraged some people, the idea of what were we fighting for, what did people die for overseas if this was happening at home. And I think when an issue can be boiled down to those really, really intensely personal things, then it gets through. Otherwise, it's just so many words.
Yeah, and Peter and I actually discussed this I think in November when I visited Toronto, but that is, it's about affecting people's, I guess, fundamental decency.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really, I mean, that's, I think, a great goal and an achievement if I can do that. And if, you know, and I'm really happy for if people like Peter can do that with their work.
And it's funny because we need the vehicle, though, and I think with IPRWASH, it was Sam George. Like, he's someone who you just can't fault what he's done. I mean, all he's done is try and find out why his brother was killed, and he's not one of these guys who loves to be out in the media. He's not someone who sort of puffs himself up for the cameras, but he's just this thoroughly decent guy who thinks that the system should work, and it's, you know, if it wasn't for that vehicle, if Dudley George didn't, if he didn't have a brother like that, or he didn't have someone we could basically use to tell the story and keep the story moving, I don't know where it would be, really.
Yeah.
I mean, with the Milgaard story, it was the same thing. I mean, the story was really about the mother, you know, like, you know, hanging out there trying for her son when nobody else cared. And I think you need that thing that just makes it really, really personal, where people go, you know, what would I do in that situation? Could I be that strong?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's funny, as soon as people meet Sam, he's been going around just, you know, as much as he can, meeting people and trying to get people to do things. And as soon as they meet him, they think there's a thoroughly decent guy, and I don't care who he votes for, I don't care about his politics, but this shouldn't have happened to his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I've spoken to some groups that are, you'd think would be way, way off on the right, and as soon as you talk to them about what should Sam have done, how did this, if he's a victim, how did he bring it upon himself, what's he done wrong, you know, people really, really get behind him. I was at something in Orillia, which is where the OPP have their headquarters, and I thought we'd get a really hostile reception from some people, and at the end of it all, people are running up and giving Sam money. I mean, it was, you know, to keep the court fight going, and there wasn't one negative question, and this was a town where they're probably one of their largest single employers is the OPP, which killed Sam's brother.
The only violence I have ever experienced in my life is the violence of being hungry, the violence of being called a dirty Indian, the violence of racist education and double standards of court. That's the violence that we have had to deal with.
Coming up, a discussion with Arthur Manuel on resistance movements within Indigenous communities today. Now, we'll return to a conversation with Allison Blackduck and Peter Edwards. Both are journalists. Allison has a bi-weekly column at the Toronto Star, and Peter is a reporter at the Toronto Star as well. I asked Peter if he had received any journalistic training on covering Native issues.
For me, no. And I found it troubling that I've got a degree in history, and I didn't know a thing about Tecumseh until the, you know, covering the IPRWASH story, and Tecumseh died 45 minutes from where Dudley George was killed, and so I found it really, really embarrassing how little I knew. Where I got most of my opinions on First Nations issues was just growing up by a reserve, so that when I was a little kid, it wasn't something, you know, exotic or different. They were just, you know, some other kids that you play baseball with or something. You know, it wasn't a big political deal. The IPRWASH thing was really just stumbling. I remember in the first week, some people were at Stony Point were really upset with the media because the Stony Pointers were being called a rebel band, breakaway band, splinter group, all these things. And it was, I remember someone telling me just how ignorant this was and really, really being upset. And it wasn't until I started working on the book that it hit me why he was so upset. Like, this was a guy who's actually descended from Tecumseh's family, and they had been there for, you know, centuries, and had actually, they're part of the reason where, you know, Southern Ontario wasn't part of the United States. I mean, Tecumseh died right in that area fighting an American Harrison who was invading Canada. And so the fact that this guy's descended from this huge hero and people, you know, are just writing off the band as some kind of riffraff that doesn't belong there was unbelievably offensive to him. And it wasn't until a couple of years later that it, you know, when I went through a lot of archives and that sort of thing that it dawned on me. And then I remember talking to him later. This guy's name is Glenn George, and he, as soon as he saw that someone actually made the effort to poke around a bit on their own, he was just a totally different guy. Like, he's like the sweetest guy you'd ever meet now.
Yeah, and I think, but you're talking about asking about whether, you know, I think what you're somewhat implying, Gretchen, is that maybe these issues should be taught in university, and I'm skeptical about that too, because one thing I really can't stand is I meet so many well-educated Canadians who have done the courses, you know, the diversity courses, and they're so scared to question anything I say, and they're like, they're so aware of it, and they're so self-conscious of it, that I don't really know whether it really advances knowledge or the debate, because I think a lot of those courses get bogged down in political correctness, and so that's my kind of two cents on those types of courses. I mean, those courses in some ways are good because I think they, for me, they gave me a vocabulary with which to talk about some of these issues, and in some ways they, like, some of the things, readings I did, you know, legitimized or validated some of my, you know, intuition, my intuitive feelings, but I think, I don't know, maybe we have to be counterintuitive about how we educate people about covering a different community. I don't know. What do you think, Gretchen?
Well, what I was actually wondering is if there was any kind of standardization in terms of the kinds of research that that people are taught about in say journalism courses. Are they taught how to investigate a community? For example, Peter was just talking about Ipawar's case. Those journalists covering that could have easily just gone into the area and not made the assumptions that this was a breakaway band, and actually talked to the people there and found out from the community what were the issues and the history of the people in the area and the people who were making the land claim,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to just making the assumption that it was a breakaway band.
Yeah, well, I think that just comes from a personal perception. I think that one thing that I think handicaps a lot of Indigenous people greatly, especially those ones who are really, like, physically, where it's physically evident that this person is Native, because there's a lot of Native people who don't look very Native, is that we're often seen as less than or more than. We're never really seen on as being equals, and I think that's a perceptual shift that has to happen, and unfortunately it's very personal. You know, what do you think, Peter?
Yeah, one thing I find, that less than or more than thing really hits me. Like, I know there's that whole Dances with Wolves thing. And at one point I wanted to do a story on a group in Toronto called the White Buffalo Society or whatever, and it's basically people who rented the video one time too many. And there's a feeling from editors that I'd be making fun of them, and you know, frankly, I would have been making fun of them, but I just thought it was funny. And maybe it was like, don't go there, please don't go there, you know, like, we don't want to open all this up. And it's one of those, I mean, it wasn't the biggest story in the world. I guess a lot of people in the media, too, see Native stories as being really emotionally draining, like, you know, suicide and just things that in the end just leave you feeling really raw and depressed, and so they're almost afraid to go there. And so it's nice when there's something that's just, you know, just kind of relaxing.
Yeah.
Well, is that, I mean, that kind of seems like there's an assumption there that there aren't those, you know, powerful, moving stories that aren't depressing, that aren't suicidal, that those stories are indeed out there.
Yeah, they are, but I think the other thing that people, and I think what happens too is I see a lot of profiles of people and where they're, like, held up as role models. And I worked at the Natsiak News last summer in Iqaluit, and the editor there, Jim Bell, who's, oh, he's fabulous. Very eccentric, but fabulous. And he's not Inuit at all. He's actually from Ontario. But he's been living in what's now Nunavut for, you know, more than two decades. And he said that the problem with doing kind of role modeling journalism is that what happens if those role models fall? You know, we sometimes we set people up to fall. And I think it kind of goes back to the more than, less than.
Yeah.
And I think that, I think what Peter's talking about is more, that's more kind of, I think that's more effective. And I don't know.
Well, even something like current issues, like the amendments to the Indian Act. I haven't seen anything in the mainstream press about these amendments that were proposed last February or last fall, and will probably most likely be on the table again this spring before the session ends.
Right. Well, but sometimes, I mean, there's nothing stopping people from going to, you know, something like turtleisland.org, which I really enjoy because, I mean, that's actually where I got a lot of my updates. And so I think, you know, the onus is on, you know, people to seek out alternative forms of media coverage.
But we do have this mass media. You know, here in Canada, we have the CBC, which is a publicly funded network, you know, subsidized by some corporations and advertising. But at the same time, they have all of this airspace on television, also on radio.
Mm-hmm.
But how much airtime are they dedicating to these amendments to the Indian Act, which will, you know, fundamentally change Canada's relationship with Native North America forever? I mean, this is a finality that they're trying to pass.
Right. Well, CBC is CBC special. You know, it's unfortunately, I think what CBC is facing right now is that they're really having to justify their existence, and I think that I have a feeling that CBC is really going more for a quick buck rather than being more somber and reflective like it has been in the past. Like, the glory days of CBC are really over. I mean, it's really having to redefine itself, and so I don't know whether the editorial focus is there anymore, and that's unfortunate, but...
Well, Peter, why do you think that, you know, mainstream media out there is not dedicating any time to these amendments?
To be honest, you know, I think people just see it as kind of a blah, 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 you know, bunch of words, and in the end, everything's the same.
Mm-hmm.
I know that sounds pretty pretty negative, but I don't see them, people are seeing this as anything, you know, really concrete to do with their lives. It's kind of like the Flat Earth Society type of thing.
Well, yeah, and I think I just thought of something, and I think that, you know, this has been, I mean, the Indian Act is actually like a whole compilation of acts, and I mean, this is just the nature of the Indian Act that it gets passed, you know, I don't know if it's going to be passed, but I mean, that changes are made without any consultation. So it's just more of the same, and I mean, it's more of the same for Native people too, and it's, I think it's more of the same, unfortunately, for, you know, for people who may be reading newspapers or watching the news.
You know, we've already discussed the powerful nature and the effect of social change that journalism can create.
Mm-hmm.
So where does that powerful change and the powerful tool that journalism is, where does that apply to trying to change the federal government's course on Indian policy?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think journalism can do it right now because it's something that has to come from people. And right now I'm just working on entertaining people, challenging people in my way.
Well, Peter, I wonder if you can comment on that as well. Roger Obenswan had made the comment that the feds often feed the press the information about federal policy on federal Indian policy, and oftentimes it's exactly what the press prints. It's federal policy, word for word. Do you think the opposite is possible, where Indigenous people are actually feeding the press their take on Indigenous policy, and the press is printing it word for word?
First of all, I don't really think we see our job as printing, you know, kind of anything word for word as much as, you know, accurately catching what people are thinking. But, I mean, ideally, if everybody's a bit mad at you, you know, you're probably doing your job. There's a saying in journalism, if you want a friend, get a dog. Like, it's not your job to pick a side and join it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, honestly, if I found out tomorrow that Dudley George had a gun, I'd write that too. But in 6.5 years of looking at it, it's, you know, it just looks more and more like a travesty. And I think that's where your credibility comes from, when you're not really on a side. Like, if... And it's odd because that's where being an outsider probably did help a bit at Ipperwash, that I didn't know anyone, and that frankly, you know, in the next day, if a story had come up that had showed the police were in some kind of a danger, I would have written that too. But, you know, 6.5 years of looking, and it's pretty one-sided with where the truth is. And so I don't see my role as, you know, picking a side. And then I think if you take that attitude, then when the Sam Georges come along, these, you know, spectacularly decent people, you know, then it maybe has a little more credibility.
Anybody who wants to do really good reporting on Indigenous issues should really go back and look at what's already been done, because there's a lot of traps that even I've fallen into that I didn't know I was falling into. I at once had fallen into the myth of the vanishing Indian, and oh my God, where are we going? Our lives are being ruined. And then I looked at Saturday Night articles from like the turn of the century, last century, and people are writing the same stuff. I've fallen into like this a construction, a myth, and I think that people have to challenge their assumptions. And because a lot of times what we accept as fact is really just in fact something that was just made up in the first place. Do you understand what I'm saying, Peter and Gretchen?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, if everybody believes a myth, then it becomes a reality sort of thing.
Yeah.
And, if everybody's afraid of someone, then he's dangerous because he's making everybody afraid, even if there's nothing dangerous about him.
Yeah.
I mean, I tried to sound profound, and I kind of missed there. But it's just... one thing that really, really hit me about, and I keep going back to Prohaska, it's really, basically all I know, the people in the neighborhood who are the cottagers, they were so, so terrified of their neighbors, and when you go around and say, what were you afraid of, they just don't have anything to really hang it on. And what hit me was that you can always play to that lowest common denominator. Instead of saying, why don't you guys go play baseball together or something really basic, it's, let's call in the police, it's funny how it's just so bizarre when you go to that area that, that some people just want to live with their myths. Like they're more comfortable with this myth of another community being scary than actually getting to know somebody.
Yeah,
I found it really bizarre. Once I was on the radio near Kettle Point, and I was talking about Iprawash, and this woman phoned in, got really, really mad, and he said, "You people always expect this and that." And I said, "Lady, I'm as white as you are." And she started swearing at me and hung up. But it was just bizarre. Like, there's the feeling, with her, it was just really genuine. It's us and them, and there's, it can never cross over. And every once in a while, a story can get people to cross over a bit. Like, when people look at the Sam Georges or the Clifford Georges, then they forget their politics for a while and just see a human being, and, that's kind of the whole point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just, I think the biggest task, for me as a journalist, is just humanizing, myself for my readers, and I think just by doing that, maybe the next time somebody who's never really met an Indigenous person will go, maybe their perception will be shifted just a bit. And for, people who are non-Indigenous, Indigenous, I'm sorry, I'm referring to non... Anyway, for people who are, Indigenous, to say that I want those readers to feel that, it's okay to be cantankerous and not believe that, organizations like the AFN are always, the good guys. It's okay to question our own, because and it's okay to question our own publicly, because I don't think we do that enough.
Well, we've talked a bit about, the responsibility of the media mm-hmm. tonight and the power that they have, too, and I guess both of you as well. So I'm wondering, what kind of advice would you give to journalists who potentially maybe covering these amendments to the Indian Act? I know, Allison, you had mentioned getting a copy of the Indian Act yourself, or the first Governance Act.
Yeah, I've looked at. Right now, I'm really swamped with other things, and I think I just might kind of walk away from this one. But in terms of people who want to cover it, oh God, I don't know what kind of advice I'd give. I really don't know. Peter?
I think I'd couple it in with the leadership race that's going on in the background, because a lot of it is just, I'd also be interested in how many First Nations delegates are out there, how many people can actually have a vote on the next leader. In 84, there was a feeling that they just might, out west be a couple of ridings that, this sounds really, really awful, but I think there's truth to it, is that the politicians are, if they don't think that there's a negative consequence in the vote, then, they a lot of times don't care. And so I'd be interested how many First Nations people are actually going to be Liberal delegates, and where are they from? How much power do they have in those ridings? It's really, really obvious from Upper Wash that the conservatives knew that they weren't losing any votes with what they did. You know, that it was an ugly, ugly thing, but it, you know, the MPP from that area got reelected strongly. So, you know, if a politician sees his job as getting reelected, then I think it's our job to take a look at, you know, how might this affect them. I think sort of overall just advice for journalists, the idea would be that it's our job to be an honest witness, you know, nothing more than that. Like, and that's Mark Eichler saying, I didn't think that went up, but, you know, he always got slammed by people in the Jewish community saying that he should be this and he should be that for them, and he'd say, I'm just being, you know, an honest witness, and that's all one person can do, and, you know, even that's a little hard.
Yeah, and, I mean, I guess I should, you know, go back to your question. I think the only advice that I would give is when journalists are, you know, is not to, you know, invalidate claims of native sovereignty, because I think for me, like, part of my political position, you know, against or whatever in regards to the FNG is that I don't really feel like has very much jurisdiction over me anyway, because it's part of this Canadian state that I've stated before I don't really feel a part of. It's not that I have any contempt for it, but I feel that just given my status, and I'm not referring to, like, my Indian status, but just given to the colonial history, I mean, I just, like I said, I've just kind of stepped away from it and stepped outside of it, and I work outside of it. And I think that for any journalist, I mean, claims of native sovereignty, I mean, they're not just, they have to be taken seriously, and unfortunately, like, especially with John Stackhouse, you know, he was writing about it. I could tell by reading him that he wouldn't even begin to consider the idea of native sovereignty. Like, the only idea of native sovereignty that he saw was one that existed within, you know, Canada, as it's defined by its Constitution and Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And I think that, you know, I'm very much a believer in the thoughts expressed by people like Tyagi Alfred, and some of the attitudes that come out of the Mohawk Nation, especially, like, you know, and that's what I mean by stepping away and not being afraid to step away.
Allison, I was really interested because in your column you wrote, I've almost stopped reading stories about Indigenous people in the popular press because I'm insulted by the coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you've touched on a lot of the things that journalists can do to kind of not insult you. what is so insulting about the media that's out there?
Like, it's just what I said. They a lot of journalists don't take my fundamental beliefs about myself and other Indigenous people in this land seriously. It's just like, oh yeah, native sovereignty. Uh-huh. Next. And they also are writing from such a position of ignorance. Like, you know, Jonathan Kay, like, assimilation, like, the National Post has been talking about assimilation since it began in 1998, and I don't know, like, so many letters to the editor have been written about, well, assimilation's the problem. That was the whole point of, like, you know, the original Indian Acts, and so that's really more what I'm insulted by, is just the willful ignorance.
Peter, do you find that kind of willful ignorance among your colleagues? Not necessarily at the Toronto Star, but just in the field of journalism in general?
I think people always want the easier route to go, and I think one problem that we've had in the media sometimes when First Nations people have been polite and sort of you know, sitting back, like at Kettle Point or Stony Point, waiting 58 years for a simple promise that would cost about $500 to be honored. You know, I mean, there's not many you know, white guys I know who'd sit around and, you know, and expect people to honor their word for that long. You know, like that, I don't know if Wilford, well, I guess, I mean, I hate to buy into that term, but I guess they sort of have to. I mean, we want kind of quick fixes, and it's sort of, we want something flashy to go in front of us and to chase that, and so we want things easily packaged, nice pictures.
It almost sounds like you're describing a two-year-old.
Well, yeah, maybe a six-year-old, they would like to think, or, I don't know, I don't, well, you know, we kind of like those quick themes, and I guess, I mean, it sounds weird, but I think just going into something with a blank slate and letting, you know, that cliche about you write every story like you just came into town and like you're just going to leave town that night, you know, like the idea that just sort of be an honest witness and see where that takes you, and get a dog so you don't need too many friends.
Well, that's sort of the opposite approach that we're taking here. I mean, this series is called the Long-Term Memory Radio Project, and one of the things that we're trying to do is get a grasp on that history that is so often missing from news media or television media, newsprint media or television media.
Actually, you hit one really good point there. Was I guess one thing I've really, really learned from the Upper Wash thing is that news doesn't just have to be what happened today or yesterday. I mean, in 3 weeks, there's going to be 1,600 people in the building, and most of them will be teachers, bussed in from all over the province to make noise about, the terrible thing that happened to Dudley George. And, 3 years ago, they couldn't have gotten 100 people into that building. And so sometimes news is just what people are feeling. It's not just a reaction to yesterday or today or tomorrow. Sometimes with a little effort, people can take a longer view. And I think, it sounds sort of like what your mother would say to guilt you, but I think people do want to be better. I think people deep down do want to do the right thing, and I think sometimes that we just have to kind of serve it up for them to a point.
Yeah. Nicely said.
Oh, wow, I got one.
No.
Well, I thank you both for joining us for this episode of the Long-Term Memory Radio Project.
Oh,
it's,
thank you.
It's been a great discussion.
Oh, thanks, Gretchen.
Had you heard the new word? Kick it to the sub. The time is now, cause action's a strong verb, but only if you use it. Please don't confuse it, do what you said, not the same old retread.
Like Reagan and Bush, it's time to push out the old. Just do what you're told and what you said, cause their words are left but dead. And in the end, actions speak louder than words.
The government will tell you what they're gonna do. In the meantime, we get the voodoo. Like a corkscrew, they'll go through ya. Put the word in your ear and go booyah.
But their actions lack in satisfaction. Our reaction depends on our passion to make the liars all retire. Cause their words better unheard. Cause a man of actions, what's happening? Till it stops, I won't stop rapping. To kill a DC songbird, cause when it's done, actions speak louder than words.
To the youth, it's time for some action.
It's time
to
for some
elders,
action.
It's time for some action. It's
so what we're going to do now is just talk about some of the proactive movements that have been happening in First Nations lands to, first of all, see how people can get the government to change its tune, and then what kind of vision is being proposed. So maybe we'll start with that. What can communities do when the federal government comes knocking with this First Nations Government Act?
Well, I think one of the things they have to do is just not talk about it to the government. The government's basically got this, basically a public relations scheme to try and capitalize on the fact that band administrations and chiefs, to a certain extent, have to operate within very limited, restricted, and tough budgets, and then people develop some kind of sense that the problem is purely that of the Indian Band Council. And a lot of times, it has to do with the fact that the funding is just not there, the program services, the basis isn't there to deal with the problem. Basically, Indian bands sometimes have a $1,000 problem and they're budgeted only $10 in terms of resources for those issues, and the thing is that the problems occur that way. I think that Indian communities and Indian bands have to put the onus back on the federal government by not falling into the trap of being used by the federal government. Anytime you meet with them, they want to be able to record that in their affidavits that they have consulted with Indian people, that they got participation, and they're not really interested in what you say. They just want to make sure that you made some comments and that they can register that we consulted with so many thousands of Indians, and they all agreed that we need to have changes, and then they'll proceed with the changes that they want. I just say, just don't get tricked into that kind of public relations scam that they're trying to pull off, and be very vocal in your local media. about that kind of thing, and give your support to, I guess, the national organization that passed a resolution. The Assembly of First Nations passed a resolution rejecting that proposition of amending the existing act.
So, what kinds of things can communities do to regain that self-sufficiency in the face of this government legislation?
One of the things here in British Columbia is that, we haven't had any agreements or treaties with the federal government regarding our traditional territories. So, and we have since had Section 35 of the Constitution protect Aboriginal rights, and we have also had the Supreme Court of Canada on December 11th, 1997, come down with the Delgamuukw decision and basically recognizing Aboriginal rights as a collective proprietary interest, which basically gives us right to get out on the land. And that's what I really encourage my people to do is, the government has ignored the proposal by us to recognize and reconcile Aboriginal title with Crown title interest. And because they've rejected that, the people have to either accept that or they have to fight it. And one way of fighting it is getting out in the land. And that's what my people have done. They've literally set up several camps and carried on an ongoing type of protest as well as occupation of their traditional lands. And this is this large ski resort area that this Japanese company, Nippon Cable, owns. Mr. Moshiashi Okubo is the president of that company. But anyways, they have bought this company out. And it's in the $300 million type operation. It operates near Kamloops in B.C. And the thing is that they just announced recently that they wanted to expand it by $70 million, building a Delta Hotel. And I'd encourage people not to deal with those guys until they get out of Sun Peaks. The thing is that they basically wanted to expand it by $70 million. And the thing is that we've been out there and we've been fighting it. Our elders, the land users, the Native youth movement have all gotten involved in that struggle.
That touches on one of the other things that I wanted to ask, which is First Nations people living in the cities who are shut out even more of any kind of land rights future. What is being done to, the Native Youth Movement is largely an urban movement, but what kind of future can there be for people to have the option of having their homeland in the country or actually having some kind of future in the city, whatever people choose to do?
Well, one of the things is that I'm not really, I don't really work in the Friendship Center movement anymore. In fact, I was one of the founding presidents of the Friendship Center of Montreal way back in many, many, many years ago. Anyways, I used to be involved in urban issues back then. But now I'm more concerned about the rural area, like where I am. But the thing is that what we've done out here is that the Sagopmuk Native Youth Movement chapter invited the Native Youth Movement to get involved in supporting us up at Sun Peaks. And so we do have a number of people from urban areas that have come out into our area and are working under the direction of our youth organization and our elders and our land users and getting out in the land. And I really find that very inspiring. I find it very encouraging to see young people from all over sort of get involved and out on the land. And it really brings about a whole new sense of hope, a new sense of encouragement for them to be out there, to be in the struggle. And I really appreciate their work. And I think, the Native Youth Movement can do a lot in bridging that gap between the urban and the rural area, because what these young people are doing when they get out and use the land up in the Squawkwalt, or that Sun Peaks area, when they get out in Squawkwalt, they basically are opening up hope and future for the next generation of young people, because the existing reserves right now are really way too small, you know, to sustain the growing, basically exploding population of Native people. So they have to get out on the land, and they have to force, you know, recognition of new exclusive use areas for our people, and bury traditional use activity areas too. Because the thing is that, you know, Indian communities have been basically static since they started. You know, like when Montreal grew, they extended the border. Any major city grows, they extend the border. Indian reserves have remained static. They haven't had any growth or dimension since then. But then, yet the population is larger. So when these youth get out there in these new traditional territory, they're actually building hope for themselves.
Is there anything that you want to add that we hadn't had a chance to talk about?
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the things is that right now we're preparing the Native youth and the elders now preparing to go to court on Friday, because the Sun Peaks ski resort is going to seek an injunction to have us removed from the first camp that we set up at the entrance bay of the Sun Peaks resort. And that's really funny, because, you know, here we have this corporation that was just set up not too long ago, and historically, and they're trying to remove us as Indigenous people. But our young people have been very strong. I know they occupied the BC Assets and Lands Corporation. 14 of them got arrested. They had to basically sacrifice their personal liberty for the freedom of the people. I know two elders also got arrested in that, and they did the same thing. But also six more warrants have been issued to against some of the young people. They were arrested too, and they're going back to court on such issues as mischief and that, for their participation in political demonstrations at Sun Peaks. But I just raise that simply because the system is really not trying to resolve the issue by good faith negotiations, but they're trying to resolve it through using the RCMP to administer Indian affairs. It's back to the old time when they fought with Poundmaker, or they fought with Piapot, or these other chiefs, where they used the Northwest Mounted Police to deal with Indian affairs. And they don't try to deal with it like the Supreme Court of Canada said, like Chief Justice Mayer said. He said, deal with this through good faith negotiations. You know, they're not prepared to do that. They're resorting to the use of force, and I think that Canadians have to be very embarrassed about Canada and in its treatment of its people out here.
This is Arthur Manuel of the Nisqually First Nation out in BC. I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us, and I wish you a good dinner. Bon appétit, as we say.
Okay, thank you. Bye. Okay, bye.
Bye.
The politicians keep on dissing, voice of the people, but they won't listen. And when they speak, it's not our words they speak,
but the words of a sucker that paid him last week. And if it came down to the real fact,
if a politician was a crime, it'd be a carjack.
They make the promises you vote, and I bet ya the promise they made last week, I forget ya. No class and all talk, your ass to the sidewalk, cause you've been jacked by the man with the smooth talk. Gangs is his game, politics is claim, the famous time to take aim.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Long-Term Memory Radio Project. For more information on this series, contact CKUT at 514-398-6787, extension 2593, or news at cKUT.ca. Next week, we'll present part 3 of this 4-part series on how Aboriginal women have been impacted by Canadian Indian policy.
I think there's an understanding in the United States, Mexico, and Canada that the final termination of Native people is going to occur. Chrétien now sees his opportunity, and he's in the final stages of being Prime Minister, to really push the white paper through.
A genocidal mentality is inherently ecocidal in its implications. It eradicates the habitat that you, as well as we, depend upon for survival. You combine genocide and ecocide, you get omnicide.
Introducing a four-part series on CKUT 90.3. Legislation will be presented this spring, potentially changing Canada's relationship with Native North America forever. Tune into this station for Long-Term Memory Radio, a four-part series on Canada's relationship with Native North America every Wednesday throughout February from 5 to 6 p.m.
The liberation of Native North America becomes priority number one for anyone serious about ultimately winning the struggle at hand.
CKUT, Long-Term Memory Radio.